You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why it may take more than facts to change someone's mind.
First, the Great Lakes Compact Council met in Chicago on Monday. At the meeting, a coalition of Great Lakes mayors expressed concerns about the proposal for Waukesha to draw drinking water from Lake Michigan.
Peter Annan was at the Great Lakes Compact Council meeting, and he joins us now to talk about what happened. He's co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation and director of environmental communication at Northland College. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, we'll dig into the history. This is a long and winding road to get here, but what happened at that meeting this week?
Yeah, well, essentially, back in June, the Great Lakes governors approved a long-standing water diversion application by the community of Waukesha, a suburb of Milwaukee. And what's happened now is it seems like the mayors in the Great Lakes region are positioning themselves to challenge the governors of the Great Lakes region in court over that decision.
Right. According to the compact, as I understand it, the governors are decision makers. The mayors are not really at the table, but they could get to the table by going to court, it sounds like.
That's right. And the first, This is the whole compact system was created by the Great Lakes governors, and the mayors had a seat at the table, and there's been really quite friendly relations up until recently. But the compact doesn't allow an aggrieved party to immediately file a lawsuit. The first step is for the aggrieved party to come and appear before the representatives of the eight Great Lakes governors to basically lay out their beef and allow the gubernatorial representatives to ask questions.
And did the Compact Council try to allay the concerns of these mayors?
Not so much to try to allay the concerns, but it was quite a bit of back and forth. I mean, right out of the gate, the governor's representatives were asking the attorney for the mayor's a number of different questions, trying to get to some of the finer points of what exactly the mayors were upset about. And so it was really quite a robust discussion.
And what are the mayors worried about? What objections were they raising to Waukesha's approved plan to withdraw water from Lake Michigan?
Yeah, they have kind of two different categories of complaints. One are sort of content and the diversion approval itself, and second is more procedural. The mayors do believe that Waukesha actually does have alternate water supply options besides getting water from Lake Michigan. The compact requires a water applicant to prove it has no other water supply alternatives before turning to Great Lakes Water. Waukesha did a good job of convincing the governors that they didn't have any other water supply alternatives, that basically Lake Michigan was their last resort, and the mayors are unconvinced there and are asking the governors to go back and look at that. Secondly, there are concerns, particularly with the mayor of Racine. As you know, Waukesha has to return the water to the Great Lakes after it is used and cleaned to Clean Water Act standards, and where they're doing that is through a somewhat complicated system where they're piping it several miles to the Root River and then dumping that treated wastewater effluent into the Root River, where it then flows out to the Lake Michigan waterfront near Racine. And the mayor of Racine is quite concerned about what kind of water quality implications that might have at his beachfront. So those are a couple examples of the issues that the mayors have been raising.
Talking to Peter Annan about Waukesha's request, approved as of now anyway, to withdraw water from Lake Michigan. Objections raised this week by mayors along the Great Lakes. Peter, let's get to the root of the story. Waukesha, the water supply they have under them, has radium in it. Does that make the water untreatable, undrinkable?
Well, that's part of the great question, goes right to the heart of the debate. Yeah, so Waukesha sits on this naturally contaminated.
Peter, are you there? Peter Annan cut out on us talking about the Great Lakes Compact and efforts by Waukesha to withdraw water from Lake Michigan to meet its drinking water needs. Peter Annan, our guest moments ago and hopefully moments from now, co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation, director of environmental communication at Northland College. He's been watching this whole process, the Great Lakes Compact itself, setting rules over who can use Great Lakes water and under what circumstances, and more specifically, this effort by Waukesha to use Lake Michigan water instead of the groundwater under them, as Peter was just saying, they're contaminated with radium making it undrinkable. Hopefully, bring him in just a moment. I'll just say, coming up, well, you can share your thoughts, by the way, on Waukesha's application. If you're in Waukesha, I'd love to hear from you. If you're along the watershed, you as well. What are your concerns? Are you worried about this application to withdraw water from Lake Michigan, or you think it should move ahead as approved by Great Lakes governors? Do that on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Wisconsin Life, and then an argument, do facts change our minds? Our guest says, not really, probably not. Still having trouble raising Peter Annan, it looks like. We'll give him one more moment. Again, share your thoughts on the Great Lakes Compact efforts to withdraw water on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Still no Peter Annan. Nope, looks like we've got him. Peter, can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Oh, lovely. So briefly, Waukesha, could it treat radium and make its water drinkable? This is a concern raised by some of the other mayors, I think.
That's right. Yeah, the mayors, you know, there are other communities in Wisconsin that have a radium in their groundwater, and they've been successfully treating that radium. Waukesha is actually treating and using dilution right now to get by as well. Waukesha argues that there are no communities of its size that are doing that, and it puts them in a different category. And this is one of those things, again, where the governors were convinced by that argument, the mayors are not, and they want the governors to review it again.
So what are you looking for in the next steps? It sounds like mayors are headed to court. Do we have a sense of when that might be?
Yeah, and so the next step first is for the governors are going to take the mayor's complaint under advisement. First, they wrote a long legal brief, or several of them actually, in which the governors have all read. They heard the oral arguments on Monday. The governors want a few weeks to review that, and we hope to have a decision from the governors on whether or not they will review what the mayors have asked them to by early May. And then if there's no change, then the mayors have a choice of letting it drop or continuing on to federal court. Or if there is a change, then we'll be back looking at Waukesha's situation in more detail.
Lengthy process. Briefly, if it weren't for this court process, how long would it have taken for Waukesha to start actually using Lake Michigan water?
Yeah, it's many years. It's a $220 million project. Probably that's an old number. That's probably going to go up. They have to get a right-of-way for the pipeline in and the pipeline out. It's many, many years down the road. It's you know, I did my first Waukesha interview for my book 13 years ago, and it just keeps on ticking.
I'm sure we'll talk to you again, Peter. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks, Rob.
That's Peter Annan, co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation and director of the Environmental Communication at Northland College. He joined us to talk about the Great Lakes mayors who expressed concerns about the Waukesha water diversion proposal from Lake Michigan at this week's Great Lakes Compact Council.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out why facts don't mean as much as you might think when it comes to changing someone's mind.
Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
A school field trip led Rosalind Vang to a strange place, a house filled with mannequins. She tells us about the house and what in that house caught her eye.
Nothing really happens in the small town of Beloit. Some people don't even know where it is. So the story of Mike Martin and his mannequins created a sensation that we had to see. Some say Mike built the house, a two-story colonial estate, in 1963 by himself. Peeling white paint, unstable front steps, and forgotten Christmas decorations welcomed us. We first encountered the mannequins in the living room. Clothed in extravagant dresses and accessorized with sparkling jewelry, every single one seemed prepared for our mobile cameras. Large fake eyelashes sprouted from their glass eyes, and their lips were overdrawn with color. I focused on their gallon-sized breasts, sticking out of their slim bodies. Racks overstuffed with glamorous gowns lined the dining wall, and formal shoes piled onto the floor, marking their territory. The kitchen looked like something straight out of a 70s sitcom, very yellow. It was empty except for a white box sitting on the island. It seemed out of place. My eyes lingered on its surface and it read in elegant gold cursive, "Your wedding day." I lifted the top and uncovered a wedding dress. It was slightly discolored with puff sleeves and lace details, suggesting the 1980s. I didn't have the courage to fully remove it for a more thorough inspection. It felt too intimate and historical. Was this Mike's wife, Maxine's, wedding dress? Why'd she leave it? Rumor had it that Maxine packed up her bags as soon as her husband died. Maybe she left the dress here to claim her space, to stop the infestation of her husband's artistry. Maybe she wanted to leave behind anything that tied her to the house. Maybe it was too emotionally unbearable to take. Maybe it simply lost its value and was considered useless. We toured the rest of the house, but there wasn't much else to see. The mundane objects around the estate yearned silently to be seen, while everything mannequin demanded attention. It was the wedding dress, though, that created a lasting impression. Its abandonment overwhelmed me, and I oddly felt connected with it. Who discards a dress that marked a milestone, its sacred unification? I guess many do. In the back of my closet at home, I too have an unwanted piece of clothing, my senior prom dress. In no way do these equate in significance, but they served a similar purpose. My prom dress signified the nearing end of youth and a time I spent with someone special. Circumstances have changed. I'm no longer the naive girl twirling on the dance floor. I've grown out of that ball gown. Maybe that's how Maxine felt about her wedding dress. The memories associated with an object never die, but its function can. Not everything from the past holds value or relevance. We just have to be brave enough to recognize that shift and leave it behind where it belongs.
Rosalind Vang is a student at Beloit College. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
Now, the 2016 election brought a new focus on facts, fact-checking, reliable sources, and the definition of a reliable source. But the science of how we respond to facts shows something that may or may not surprise you, even with facts. It's really hard to change somebody's mind.
Julie Beck wrote about that for The Atlantic, where she's senior associate editor. Julie, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, reading your article, I kept thinking of the Simon and Garfunkel song, The Boxer, the line, "A man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest." And it turns out that's kind of true. They were right. So why is it so hard to really hear facts that we disagree with?
Yeah, they got it pretty much exactly right. It's important to clarify is, like, people do change their minds all the time, right? Like, you know, you can encounter new evidence and you can change your mind and it's not a problem, usually. When it becomes a problem is when the facts that you're encountering suggest something that runs extremely counter to your worldview or your identity or groups that are really tied to your identity, because then to accept those facts would mean, like, radically reorienting yourself to the world, and people don't want to do that.
So one word for that reorienting is, the process that happens is cognitive dissonance, this idea that you're holding two conflicting ideas within your head at the same time, and it's apparently very unpleasant to have this. And there's a famous study that you write about, done back in the 60s, using recordings that had some static, some interference, and then the participants could decide whether they pushed a button and were able to hear things more clearly. And what happened was pretty telling about the way that we choose to zero in on things. What did it say?
Yeah. So, I mean, they had, you know, some undergrad students, as they do, listen to some speeches that had a lot of static in them. And so, for example, some of the speeches were about smoking. And so it was either, you know, said the truth, which is that smoking causes cancer, or it was arguing that smoking might not actually be linked to cancer after all. And they told the students, you know, oh, sorry, the recording's not amazing. Like, if you want to hear it better, you can press this button and it'll reduce the static for a few seconds. And what they found is that the students who were smokers were very eager to tune in to this speech that suggested that it might not be linked to cancer, whereas the non-smokers wanted to listen more to the one that did link it to cancer.
So what does that tell us? What's the takeaway?
I mean, so the process, you know, by which you kind of reduce your cognitive dissonance is motivated reasoning, and there's a lot of different things that you can do with that. You know, you can argue against the facts, you can say the evidence is weak, you can say, you know, the source that's telling them to you is, you know, not reliable. But, I mean, it starts really with what you even are willing to pay attention to. And so that study is a very sort of clear example of how people just don't even want to pay attention to the facts that are disagreeing with them. Like, they're just going to let it dissolve into static.
Right, so what happens when something is a core part of our identity and we come across something that runs contrary to that identity? Do we know in our brains or in the way that our psychology functions, how we respond to that new information that comes head on against what we believe about ourselves?
I mean, I think the thing to sort of realize about false beliefs or false knowledge or whatever you want to call it, you know, things that you think are true that are not true, is that to you, it feels the same as the truth. Like, you don't understand that there is a difference between the, you know, beliefs that you hold that are based in facts and the beliefs that you hold that are based not in facts. They feel the same. And so when you encounter information that goes against them, whether it's you know, whether you believe something is true, and it is true, and then you encounter some kind of crazy theory about it, you would obviously discount that. But you would do the same thing for something you believe that is based in not in truth at all, and then you encounter the truth. It feels the same.
We're talking with Julie Beck right now, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic, and we're talking about, one word for it would be cognitive tribalism, or why it's so hard to change people's minds about something that they're very invested in or believe to be true. And Julie, how does the media play into this kind of thing?
Yeah, it is tricky. You know, people love to talk about the fake news, and I think that's not helping. But it just makes it a lot easier to sort of selectively expose yourself to the information that is agreeable to you and ignore the rest. And that's something that, you know, people have always been able to do in different ways. You know, you can turn off the TV, you can turn off the radio, you can read whatever newspapers agree with you. But obviously the internet does make it a lot easier for you to kind of cultivate the media environment that you find most comfortable.
And you write about supporters of Donald Trump who, in a study, are confronted with side-by-side pictures of Inauguration Day crowds at both Obama's inauguration and Trump's inauguration. And you also write about Democrats who support banning the chemical BPA despite what seems to be a consensus of research that small amounts of BPA are safe. What do we know about how this question about the veracity of these various pictures and the safeness of BPA is processed in people's brains? Do they hear it as a question of true or false, or do they hear it more like, you know, who do you support? Which side are you on?
Yeah, so each situation is kind of unique. I'll use the Trump photos as an example because I think there's something really important there with, you know, Trump's been all steamed up about how not as many people came to his inauguration, and the photos pretty clearly bear that out. In the study, you know, they showed the Trump supporters both photos, and they said which one is Trump's, and many of them said that the one with more people was Trump's. But what was interesting is when they explicitly told them which photo was Obama's and which one was Trump's, and they said which one has more people, they would say that Trump's had more people, even though it clearly doesn't. And so I think a lot of people, when reporting on this, have been sort of presenting it as like, oh, isn't this like amazing, like the depths of their self-deception, blah, blah, blah. But really, like, it's not quite that. You know, I think they knew what was being asked of them. And the question, sort of behind the question of whose photo is whose, was whose team are you on? So I don't think they necessarily were, like, really believe that there's more people in that photo. They're just showing their support for Trump by saying that answer.
And so is that true for most of us, that we consider ourselves maybe more like sports fans than, you know, like reasoned individuals who are looking for truth, that we want to line up with a particular team?
I mean, I think we consider ourselves reasoned individuals that are looking for truth, right? But that's not necessarily how we always behave. And again, it really depends, too. If you're talking politics, like, some people are just not that invested in politics, so they might not be so deeply tied to being a Democrat or a Republican that it's going to exactly play out this way. And in the Trump study, you know, the number of people who said, oh, the Trump's photo has more people in it, it was small. It was significant, but it was small. So, but if you are really deeply tied to your political party or to whatever group that you're in, sometimes you don't engage with information in such a way that it really matters to you if it's true or false.
So I guess at the end of the day, the question is, how do you change somebody's mind? And let's say somebody belongs to a cult that believes the Earth is flat. So even with facts in hand, is it possible to change a person's mind?
No. I mean, yes and no, right? So if you're in a situation where, kind of like what we're talking about, where it's really, really deeply tied to your identity, this cult about the flat Earth is so important to you and it's your whole world, you're probably not going to change their mind. And it's certainly not with evidence. You know, there's definitely been stories of people sort of changing their minds through, like, person-to-person contact. There's a really powerful story a while back about the son of a white supremacist who was part of this white supremacist group, and he went to college, and he talked to all these other people from different religions and different ethnicities, and he sort of slowly saw that he was wrong. But it really, really takes a long time, and it takes, like, sort of interaction with other people. But if it's not something that's, you know, your whole world so deeply tied to your identity, then sure, like, of course facts can make a difference in that case.
Julie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Julie Beck is Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. She joined us to talk about why facts don't always change people's minds.
Coming up, our guest says baby boomers have been a scourge to American prosperity. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up today after 7, join NPR for a recap of the Senate judiciary proceedings. Special coverage will be hosted by Ari Shapiro with analysis from NPR legal correspondent Nina Totenberg. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, our next guest says the baby boomer generation, those born between 1940 and 1964, are to blame for most of America's problems. In his book, he argues that boomers are relentlessly devoted to their own enrichment at the expense of their country and children. He cites the American Psychiatric Association's definition of sociopathy to describe the baby boomer generation.
Bruce Cannon Gibney joins us now. He's a venture capitalist and the author of the book, A Generation of Sociopaths, How Boomers Betrayed America. Bruce, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you say that there's a clear culprit when it comes to just about all of the ills of our time. Debt, income inequality, climate change, cost of higher education, financial scandals. It's just a few of them. But you also say the culprit is baby boomers. How can you blame a single generation for all that?
Well, I don't blame them for everything. Some starting conditions were challenging. You know, the environment had been a problem in the United States for some time, for example. But prior Congresses, before the baby boomers assumed political power, did begin to address that with the Clean Air Act of 1963 that was passed before any boomer could really vote. And the establishment of the EPA under Nixon. What happened is that problems ceased to be addressed in a serious way during the period of boomer tenure. And because the boomers were such a large cohort and they were fairly unified in their political views, at least as to economic matters that impacted them, they were able to push policy away from responses and proactive policies and towards policies of consumption and recklessness. So, with respect to their political power, everyone understands that the boomers are an unusually large generation. They were 52% of the voting eligible population in 1982, and that's come down over time. But as they've gotten older and their voting rates have risen and their political donations have increased and they've become the governing class themselves, their influence has waxed so that they controlled both the White House and the House of Representatives by between 1992 and 1995 is when that period of consolidation happened and continued to control both to these to today, 69% of the House and obviously the White House again and large chunks of the administrative state. So it's fair to look at how the country has done in the period in which the boomers have exercised significant control. And my argument is not that America is not great, because it is. My argument is that we fail to live up to our potential because of the short-sighted policies enacted by the boomers. I'm happy to talk about any of them.
Brendan, you say the country is underperforming, that, for instance, family incomes should be higher than they are today. We can lay this at the feet of the boomers. Can you talk about some of the economic impact that you see?
Sure. So let's start with income, which is correctly a concern for a great many Americans. So average wages have not experienced sustained and significant growth since the 1970s, median wages, pardon me. The past 16 years have been something close to a lost period for income growth. We're roughly where we were in 2000 for average earning families of standard composition. But what's notable is what an impact this has had on the young, so that relative to boomer age, 25 to 35-year-olds, 34-year-olds, younger people today are making about 20% less early in their careers, and their net worth is about 50% less, while the boomers have done much better. And the reason for that is that the boomers began to divest from the foundations of prosperity, so that you know, public higher education, for example, which is free for the boomers, has been systematically defunded, so that you know, the University of California, which formerly charged $0 in tuition, about $232. In non-inflation-adjusted terms in the 1960s, about $2,000 today, now charges $13,500. Infrastructure, you know, it's increasingly difficult to get to work. People spend almost 50 hours a year on average in traffic, has been neglected, so that net infrastructure investment over the past decade has dropped down to as low as 0% net and has rebounded to a pretty uninspiring 0.5% of GDP on a net basis. And the debt, which eventually acts as a brake on economic growth, has grown from when I was born in the 1970s, it was 34% of GDP, and now it's 105% and set to grow at north of 2.5% annually for the foreseeable future. And so all the money that goes to service the debt that was accumulated in the boomer years can't be diverted to dealing with infrastructure, can't be diverted to dealing with climate, can't be diverted to dealing with public higher education, and can't be devoted to research and development, which has really fallen off even from the levels in 1986 to 0.7% of GDP today. So if you don't invest in the productive plant of the country, you can't expect the country to grow particularly rapidly. And that's exactly what we've seen over the period of peak boomer power.
So if we agree with your assessment of some of these issues, why aren't we calling them a failure of politics and policy instead of a failure of a generation, the boomer generation?
Well, it's certainly a failure of policy. I think it would be very difficult to agree that to contest the idea that the past 16 years have been some run of unmitigated success for the United States. But people had to vote for the politicians who emplaced those policies. And even though many of those policies were known at the time to have deleterious effects on society, they were pursued anyway. And the most important voting bloc were the boomers. And judging by their expressed political preferences, They did in fact favor these policies of divestment and the channeling of the resulting monies into programs that benefited them, but that cannot be sustained over the long run. And of particular note in that category are old age benefits. Now, I'm for old age benefits, but in order for them to work, we have to have a stable way for funding them. And Social Security, by its own admission, will be partially insolvent in 2034, and that will reduce payouts on the order of 16 and 27% over time for people who start collecting after the 2030s, and that's the very youngest boomers and millennials and Gen X. So you know, collecting a social resource at the expense of your children does not strike me as the most pro-social set of policies possible. But the boomers are relentlessly for maintaining the system as is, even though it's well known to be unsustainable without modification past the 2030s. The same goes for Medicare. The same goes for the environment. The same goes for public universities. At some point, you know, some amount of empathy is required for other people in society, and the other people in society now, the bulk of them are now young. The boomers, however, still control politics, and that's what I think allows us to trace responsibility back to the boomer generation.
We're talking with Bruce Cannon-Givney right now. He's the author of the new book, A Generation of Sociopaths, How the Baby Boomers Betrayed America. Let's talk a little bit about that word, sociopath. Are you using it as a clear diagnostic word here? How do you intend that word to be taken?
I go through the DSM's factors, the psychological definition in the book. But I think for our purposes, we can understand it. So the modern name for sociopathic disorders, antisocial personality disorder. So the question I pose in the book, and I think the central question about our political class today is, can you have such a thing as an antisocial society? And I don't think that you can, but those are the policies that we pursued. And an antisocial society, in my view, under the boomer tenure has been the allocation of resources for everyone's enrichment to the short-term benefit of the boomers. And I do think that is antisocial.
And looking a little bit at what you see as sort of the origin story of how the boomers came to be antisocial, as you say they were conditioned, that this wasn't something that was predestined. But what is your theory on the forces that shaped the boomers?
Well, the boomers were raised in a historically odd manner. They were the first generation in modern America to be raised at a time where prosperity was assumed to be sort of more or less effortless, where per capita income would grow 2.5-3% annually without much effort, or it might have seemed like that at the time. They were the first generation to be raised with television. RCA introduced the first mass market set in 1946, just after the war. And television has the literature shows it has unambiguously negative effects on personality and cognitive development. They were the first generation to be raised permissively. Also in 1946, Benjamin Spock's book comes out, and that's a sea change from the sort of behaviorist authoritarian parenting that had prevailed before, and different than, I think, the helicopter and tiger parenting that's coming up now. Now, what effects those new parenting techniques will have remains to be seen. We don't have the data on that yet, but we do have the data on permissive parenting. And then finally, you know, there were a number of, you know, environmental oddities that affected the boomers. It was the only generation to be majoritarian, bottle-fed in their early months. And that flipped around almost entirely in the 1970s after the Surgeon General released his report. And bottle feeding has been shown to have significant positive effects on cognitive and behavioral development. So there were a number of odd factors that shaped the boomers, and they haven't been fully repeated. So even with television, you know, there are significant parental reservations about screen time now that didn't exist in the 1950s. And all of these things were, I think, in general, unhelpful, with the exception of a fast-growing economy. You know, that's something I think we should be willing to risk, but presently we don't have to worry about that.
A lot to dig into there, but we want to get our callers in on this, too, as we talk with Bruce Cannon-Givney, the author of A Generation of Sociopaths, How Boomers Betrayed America. He's explaining why he says baby boomers are to blame for many of America's ills.
And you can join in now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about our guest's argument? If you're a baby boomer, do you think your generation is at fault for much of the state of the nation, negative or positive, if you want to make the case? Do you think baby boomers are the reason the 2016 presidential election was divisive? If you're not a baby boomer yourself, what do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're picking up our discussion now about Bruce Cannon Gibney's new book. It's called A Generation of Sociopaths, How Boomers Betrayed America.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea that baby boomers are a generation of sociopaths, antisocial behavior that baby boomers, especially as reflected in boomer politicians, made a lot of decisions that put future generations at risk? Do you buy it? Do you not? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And, Bruce, I just want to ask you briefly, I want to get to our callers, but take us up to speed, if you would, to the 2016 presidential election. How do you see that as sort of a continuation of boomer politics?
So, 2016 was obviously some sort of break for the American political system, but in order for that break to happen... There had to be some unusual preconditions, because in sort of no normal time would one, you know, for a high functioning economy living up to its potential, would one expect a Manhattan developer with some serious personal defects, at least alleged defects, be considered a credible candidate, much less be elected president. So I think the level of popular rage about the economy and about policy was a product of boomer choices that were made as early as the early 1990s. So, and again, these were somewhat politically heterodox. I think this is where the explanation has some explanatory power. You know, it was Clinton, the Democrat, the progressive Democrat, in theory, who. You know, signed the NAFTA trade deal. It was negotiated by the first Bush. It was Clinton who pursued deregulation of the financial services industry, even though that was immediately on the heels of the failure of the LTCM hedge fund. The first thing they did after that was deregulate derivatives, which was an odd response. Glass-Steagall was obviously eliminated. The Bush two decades, I think, require not a whole bunch of commentary, but the entire foundation of American prosperity, which I think is a precondition for the functioning of American politics, had eroded, and the level of anger crept up, and we had a very unusual break. And as a result, Donald Trump is president. Now, of course, both candidates were boomers. They agreed on only one issue, which was that Social Security and Medicare would remain as is, even though both of them knew, or at least one of them knew, Hillary Clinton knew, that the Social Security faced partial insolvency in 2034, and Medicare also was in long-term trouble. Neither program is in near-term trouble, just to be clear. And I think that made clear who they were catering to. Now, young people obviously didn't vote as vigorously as they might have. That's just a general trend in democracies. Young people's voting participation rates are lower. But I don't think that we can entirely blame them, because the choice was leftover number one and leftover number two, and they weren't particularly excited about either.
I'm going to jump in to make sure we get to our callers now. Let's go to Marie in Madison. Hi, Marie.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
Yes, I would have to agree with a portion of this. I do feel young people, the future retirees after the boomer years, are being mistreated in policies that this current government is setting out and passed as well, no doubt. However, I think it is really important to identify, which he just started doing, identify the policies and politicians who have actually, in my mind, done unethical and immoral things in forming policy that will affect future generations. Our country was established on certain fundamental things and continued with worthy politicians setting up programs that became the light to the world and hope to the world. And we should not be giving those up for our young people whatsoever. The retirement ages, everything, to me, is discriminatory toward future generations. By that, I do not mean that all boomers have neglected their duties toward their children. I don't think that in any way, shape, or form, or their grandchildren. But I do think specific people get in a rut as they pursue stock market and Wall Street goals and neglect the moral family goals that were a hope to the world.
Marie, thank you for that call. And Bruce, what do you say to that?
Well, I agree with the caller, Marie, that not all boomers fall into this, but a plurality of them, at least in the voting booth, you know, once every 2 years, do seem to continually reelect the politicians who pursue these policies, and the politicians respond to that. And this, you know, someone has to vote for these policies, and the caller is correct that younger generations are being mistreated by current American policy. There's a reason why the OECD has ranked the United States dead last on intergenerational equity. There's a reason why spending on seniors outpaces spending on the young by a ratio of 5-1 in the United States. There's a reason why youth poverty is slightly more than twice the rate of senior poverty. And, you know, my preference would be for no one to be poor, but in order for everyone to do well, we have to make social investments. And again, this gets back to the point, you know, you can either view society as a positive-sum game that's played out over the long term, or you can view it as a zero-sum game that's played out over the course of your lifetime. And I think, at least in the voting booth, the boomers have tended to favor, at least a plurality of them, have tended to favor the zero-sum short-term gain.
Marie, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Jenny in Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I am going to say, first off, I don't like to be negative. And I'm going to say some things that are kind of generalizations. But in my experience, I am shocked and aghast at the lack of awareness that I see in baby boomers. And their lack of sort of, and it's a generalization, but, and I'm speaking specifically about white middle class and white upper class individuals, not vesting in roles as grandparents, being more vested in traveling and seeing the world, an overinflation of their sense of what they've contributed to the world, a lack of acknowledgement of the post-war economic bump that they had and opportunities that they had. And I've heard people talk about how they're moving out of certain areas because they don't want to pay taxes to support the public schools now that their children are done. I am just floored by this. And when you try and engage or talk about the issues, you get the sense of entitlement that they've worked hard, they deserve their retirement and all of these sorts of things. And it's not that I don't question that people have worked to have things, but the disproportionate amount of resources that generation is taking up and how they're impacting the generations that come directly after them if I was part of it, I would be horrified. And I am.
Jenny, thank you so much for that call and the comment. And Bruce, that reminds me of a phrase in your book. You call them a plague of generational locusts. Jenny says, staggered by lack of self-awareness. Briefly, as we start to wrap up, how do you see it?
I think some version of what Jenny says has enormous truth. She correctly points out, and this is what I argue in the book, that it's mainly the white middle-class boomers who are driving a lot of these policies. And I don't focus on the minority experience because the minority experience is so different. Their experience is just radically different. With respect to the sort of deserving of retirement, now, I would like to see everyone have a decent retirement. But, you know, in order for that to happen, you know, there has to be some generational equity, some sharing among generations, starting with taxing, to be blunt, people like me, more heavily. But with respect to the claim that many people hear that you know, Mr. and Mrs. X deserves their Social Security because they're simply getting out what they put in. As a mathematical matter, that's not true. So on a same dollar basis, inflation adjusted basis, people get about $1.53 in total entitlements for each dollar in total entitlement taxes they pay.
And Bruce, I'm sorry we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Bruce Cannon Gibney, venture capitalist and the author of the new book, A Generation of Sociopaths, How Boomers Betrayed America. And you can keep that conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.